I'm one of those political scientists who has been deeply indebted to the thought of Eric Voegelin, especially his research on Gnosticism. And I am one of those few political scientists who regards Eric Voegelin as one of the truly original political thinkers of our century. But I've been provoked to say some few words of criticism. And one always does that with some trepidation. After these remarks, I would expect to be called an illiterate and a know-nothing. Therefore, I shall concede right off the bat that I am an illiterate and a know-nothing. However, and I'm sure Dr. Voegelin would agree with me in my estimation of myself, I would also insist that almost everyone in this room is a know-nothing and an illiterate compared to Dr. Voegelin, and I don't doubt that he would share my estimation. I'd like to ask the question, who are the illiterates in the academy? Dr. Voegelin has made some very witty and colorful remarks about intellectuals in the academy who bother conservatives like us to no end. And we've enjoyed those remarks. We enjoy hearing our persecutors called illiterates. But who are the illiterates? I'd like to transcend ad hominem charges and make some reference to so-called scientific studies. And again, I raise that term with some trepidation because Dr. Voegelin and I have had some words about political science and supposedly quantitative studies of political phenomena. Nevertheless, I am going to raise some questions which I think we must face. First off, Dr. Voegelin has referred to the populist invasion of our universities. And by that invasion, he is referring, I suspect, to the invasion of the universities by socially unworthy elements, that is, let's say, by the lower classes. I may be wrong in that interpretation, but that is the conclusion I have come to. Studies have been done on students in universities throughout the world and especially in America. Who are the illiterate students? Who are the students who know so little? Where are they to be found? Are they to be found at Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and Chicago? No. They're to be found at Chico State College and your local community college and so forth and so on. Where are the radicals to be found? Those modern Gnostics, where are they to be found? Are they found at Huntington College in Huntington, Indiana? Are they found at Chico State College or your local community college? No. They're found at Harvard and Yale and Chicago and Stanford. The most intelligent students are the most left-wing students. And I think we should face it. Secondly, let's talk about the professors. And let me say that I'm making these remarks with no attempt to defend these people. I am as appalled as Dr. Voegelin, but I think we have to face a few things. Scientific studies are being done on intellectuals, both academic and non-academic. The Carnegie Commission has commissioned an enormous study of American academics. A part of this study has been published by a conservative publisher, the American Enterprise Institute. What has been found? It has been found that the more intellectual the professor, the more left-wing he will be. And what do I mean by more intellectual? I mean that in a very specific sense. Teaching at the most prestigious university, being able to procure grants, and being able to publish and publish well. These are the indices of intellectuality which are used. There is a recent study by Charles Kadushin called The American Intellectual Elite, where both academic and non-academic intellectuals are surveyed, and it is found that they're overwhelmingly left of center, more left than any other group in this country. Now, if we're going to talk about people who are illiterate, I'm going to take that charge seriously and literally. If you look at the most literate people in this country, they are the most left-wing people. Now, I will concede that Dr. Vogelin is probably even more literate than all of these esteemed gentlemen. I have no desire to impugn his intellect. But we, the rest of us, are not on his level. And let's face it, we're in a small minority in the intellectual community. And how come? Why is that so? Why can't we convince our colleagues that they are wrong? We can call them, as Dr. Vogelin has called them, professionally incompetent. We can impugn their character, but can we convince them? With rational methods, with scientific methods, Dr. Vogelin has extolled science and reason. How can we convince them? I say this with anguish. Why can't we convince them?
They won't listen. They won't read. They refuse to answer challenges.
Well, I'm going to offer that as a question, and I'd like to hear some answers.
Professor Vogelin, do you want to add?
Then on the program we have Tibor McCann, McCann, he tells me. He's Department of Philosophy at SUNY College, Fredonia, New York. He's author of a number of articles, The Pseudoscience of B.F. Skinner, Human Rights and Human Liberties, and he tells me that he's a senior editor of Reason, and in the last February issue they ran an interview with Professor Hayek, Richard McCann.
It would not be possible for me to do justice to Dr. Vogelin's discussion and various comments that have been made here. I don't think that issues like that can be treated in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. I'm not even going to take them up. I'm going to put forth a thesis of my own. It's going to be very short. The topic order as the basis of liberty invites for me a consideration of what sort of order is at issue and what sort of liberty could be based on order. I shall discount the suggestion that we're speaking of metaphysical order, since in that sphere, we either have order or we do not have order. There isn't anything we can do about it. Moreover, it's clear to me that metaphysical reality is in order. The order about which we may be concerned is one over which human beings could have some say. The most fundamental, that is humanly significant, domain over which we could have some say is the moral domain. It appears to me that we are concerned with moral order. Everything else over which we have a say would appear to be less fundamental than this. By moral, I mean pertaining to the issue of what is right or wrong to do qua human being. This point will serve to distinguish domains of choice pertaining to all of us simply by virtue of our humanity, and domains of choice we can enjoy as doctors, teachers, tall people, women, and other groupings of human beings. What concerns me then is the kind of order in the moral domain that may be the basis of liberty. Now I should explain that by liberty, I have in mind political freedom, not free will or self-determination. That we have free will is a basic presupposition of any discussion pertaining to morality and politics. Following from the well-known philosophical motto, ought implies can. If you should act so and so, it must be open to you to choose to act so and so. The moral order then, which can be considered as the possible basis of liberty or political freedom, is of crucial importance to anyone who would put forth a good word for liberty. Unless the moral order, that is, a rationally developed moral position, a system of moral principles which can be fully justified on objective and rational grounds, unless such a order supports the political ideals of liberty. All the utilitarian, cost-benefit, and similar defenses of liberty cannot succeed conclusively, which does not mean that they are dispensable. They constitute the can, and the ought implies can, of political value. This is not a place to develop the rational moral position, of course. My clues are that a naturalist approach to justifying ethics is going to be most successful. By naturalist, I mean a justification which begins by asking the question, what is man? And rests the issue of the proper end of man on that answer. The subsequent thesis would produce, I am confident, the view I call classical egoism. The system of virtues is sound, that system of virtues is sound, which when implemented by individuals will most likely enable them to achieve a happy life, a life in accordance with what and who they are, a successful existence. Now the what pertains to human nature and the who to the particular individual that you and I are. This moral order is the best for purposes of keeping man an intelligible feature of reality itself, since it is objective and rational, and for justifying political liberty, because every person has as his or her moral responsibility the achievement of man's natural end, namely happiness, qua rational being, a community in which liberty is protected and preserved on principle by law, and one in which the protection and preservation of liberty is itself, in accordance with those principles, serves the moral purpose of every human being. This then is my sketch of the relationship between order and liberty. It may appear to be extremely abstract, but filled in, there is a lot of easily recognizable common sense in it. I venture to say that little in it is novel, but its theoretical potency seems to me to provide us with a means by which to begin a concerted effort toward the achievement of what I gather to be a common goal among those gathered here, the free society. Both a rational moral case for liberty and the private individual effort to practice the moral position which justifies it can serve as the most forceful means by which to overcome the pretensions of statists of all varieties to govern our lives to their own interests or own purposes. What I have outlined is not a formula. It is a praxis, a mode of being in intention and action, in theory and practice. Only the realization of this praxis would seem to me to promise success in what I take to be our common purpose.